we've been working with Ms. B to try to get her here for testimony. It's not like she's on it in space and unwilling participant, but she has some mental health difficulties. And the note that we have that I would propose uploading under seal.
And the next thing I know, I've seen a figure on the lathe burning, and it was swirling and swirling and swirling until it fell over on the ground.
I also ran a test on the fluid from the lung tissue to determine if any carbon monoxide was present.
Now, for what purpose would you run that test to determine whether there was carbon monoxide present?
To determine if the person was alive at the time of the fire.
Sometimes it's not so much what someone says, but how the person says it. I couldn't help but think that Tuesday morning when I heard lawyers argue about whether a particular witness should testify or simply have her testimony from a previous trial read into the record. The witness is Sarah B. Klingset. Defense attorney Aaron Hoffbacher says she can't testify because her physician says she suffers from a mental illness. The exact nature of the illness was not publicly disclosed.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Judge, what I've been handed to him is that we've been working with Ms. B to try to get her here for testimony. It's not like she's on it in space and unwilling participant, but she has some mental health difficulties. And the note that we have that I would propose uploading under seal with the court as an exhibit and that I've shared with counsel, I don't even remember. It was faxed, and I don't see a date on there when it was faxed. It ended up in my box. But the letter's dated August 30th from a doctor essentially explaining that this would be, if I may, can I just simply show you the letter? And this is the only copy that I have.
Does it say have an objection?
But Scott County Attorney Mike Walton countered.
The trouble I'm having, Your Honor, is that I think this condition that's referenced has been in existence throughout this trial. There's been numerous court findings, including appellate court findings, regarding the lack of credibility of Ms. B. Without the jury being able to make that judgment for themselves to her credibility, the state is really prejudiced in this regarding this witness.
Judge Marlita Grieve ruled that when the defense presents its testimony, they can have Klingset's words read into the record from a previous trial. But this deprives the jurors of the ability to fully evaluate her. When he sought to have his previous conviction overturned, Liggins' appellate attorney cited Sarah B. Klingset's past testimony. The appeal states a woman named Sarah B. Klingset claims she was driving by Jefferson Elementary School with her daughter the evening of September 17, 1990. She said she saw a white car with three white men. One of the men got out of the vehicle and stood next to a small fire in the grass.
Sarah allegedly called 911 that night to report the fire. Then she went home briefly and returned to the area after first responders had arrived. She says she was questioned by police that night, but the defense brief claims Stanley's attorneys never received the report. In a post-conviction hearing in 1999, Sarah testified about what she could remember from that night. She said she stopped her car and spoke with the man who was standing outside of the vehicle. She asked what they were doing, and the man allegedly said they were just having fun. When the car drove away, Sarah testified, her daughter took a blanket out of the trunk and they tried to put out the fire. She said the flames were too intense to see what was burning, but she assumed they were logs.
A man had got out of the car and he's just laughing, talking all loud, and drinking beer. He had beer and stuff. So I told my kids, because I had my children in the car, I wasn't going to go any further. But something told me to sit there. So I sat there. And the next thing I know, I've seen a figure on the lathe burning, and it was swirling and swirling and swirling until it fell over on the ground.
Even Stanley Liggins' lawyer from his last trial, Mike Toby, is skeptical of her testimony.
But, you know, I have to say I've always been amazed that the number of people who just happened to drive up that hill next to that school on that night.
Okay.
Including you. I mean,
I was just, there.
It just seems like everybody and their best dog drove by that school off of Marquette that night.
And Bill Davis says Sarah is completely unreliable. He disputes her story of what happened the night of the murder. And he says if she had reported that story in 1990, police would have investigated it.
I don't believe it at all. I know the officers very well. It went door to door and went to her door, and she gave a different story to him at that time. Why would he? You know, the case is new and fresh to us. We haven't charged anybody yet. We're just gathering information. Why would he alter anything that she said?
Sarah's son served time at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, where Stanley served time after he was convicted.
Well, I didn't hear about it until after I convicted the man that she was so certain was innocent twice. Then she comes forward and testifies to something just didn't happen. And she testifies after she had visited with her son in prison, who knows Stanley. And she's able then to come back and get the information passed to her through her son that she wants, or he wants, presented. Also, at that time, her daughter was a friend of one of my daughters, and I can't believe that they wouldn't have said something to my daughter.
Contrary to what Sarah B. Klingset said, the autopsy report, as well as testimony provided Tuesday by Stephen Eck, a criminalist from the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation, indicate Jennifer was dead when her body was set on fire. Eck's testimony was read into the record by Mike Walton.
As I said, I did this and I found nothing.
You found no presence of any gasoline or hydrocarbon and no presence of alcohol, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That would indicate to you, based on your training and experience, that those substances were not present in the lungs from which the tissue was taken.
Yes, that is correct.
The lung tissue, did you run any other tests concerning that?
Yes, I also ran a test on the fluid from the lung tissue to determine if any carbon monoxide was present.
Now, for what purpose would you run that test to determine whether there was carbon monoxide present?
To determine if the person was alive at the time of the fire or combustion around that person.
So the result of that test would tell you whether or not the person was alive at the time of the fire.
I found less than 1% carboxyhemoglobin was detected in the bloody fluid.
And carboxyhemoglobin is what?
That's the amount of carbon monoxide contained in the hemoglobin.
Is there any relevance of that?
That would indicate that the person had not breathed any complete combustion prior to the sample being taken.
Tuesday's testimony was heavy on science. Lieutenant Denny Kern, who once headed the Davenport Police Department's Identification Bureau, testified for several hours about the forensic work. Kern said Liggins' car at Peugeot and his room at the Hillside Inn in Rock Island, Illinois, was searched for fingerprints, fibers, hairs, and any other trace evidence that linked him to Lewis. None were found linking Jennifer to Liggins' room or car, or Liggins to the schoolyard where Jennifer's body was found. DNA testing was in its infancy in 1990 when Jennifer was killed. But Sabrina Seehofer, a criminalist with the Iowa State Crime Lab, said in 2016 she tested stains on sheets taken from Stanley Liggins' hotel room.
First, the partial DNA profile that I got information at 8 of the 15 locations from the sperm fraction of stain 11.3 was consistent with the known DNA profile of Stanley Liggins. The probability of finding this profile in a population of unrelated individuals chosen at random would be less than 1 out of 320 million. But because these are seminal fluid samples, I also have an epithelial fraction from that sample as well. And that epithelial fraction, I was unable to develop a DNA profile from stain 11.3.
And next?
The next stain that I sampled was the sperm fraction for stain 11.4. Once again, I got a partial DNA profile at 8 of the 15 loci that was consistent with the known DNA profile of Stanley Liggins. This time, the probability of finding this profile in a population of unrelated individuals chosen at random will be less than 1 out of 5.2 billion. Once again, the epithelial fraction or the skin cell fraction from the sperm stain did not yield a DNA profile.
And so it went for stain after stain on Stanley's sheets. Each time, Sabrina Seehofer would say the odds of the stain not being Stanley Liggins was hundreds of millions to one or billions to one. She also found evidence of sexual partners in the stains. But the DNA from that individual or individuals had diminished to the point that it could not be determined whether it was Jennifer Lewis's. On Wednesday, the prosecution is expected to finish presenting its case. Testimony from Jennifer's mother, Sherry McCormick, and Stanley Liggins' cellmate, Frank Rising, is expected.
I'm Benjamin Payne, reporter with WBIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm speaking with Scott Reeder, who is in Waterloo, Iowa, to cover the retrial of Stanley Liggins, who was charged with the murder of 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis in 1990. Scott, thank you for joining me again.
It's wonderful to be here, Ben.
So who came to the witness stand on Tuesday? I understand the prosecution is still calling up witnesses.
They sure are. They're expected to finish up on Wednesday with calling witnesses for the prosecution. Then it's all the defense's case. They had a DNA expert come in. They had a lot of supportive witnesses, people who were police officers, other people that worked the case that were kind of supporting what others have said. The big star witness today, I guess, would be Denny Kern. He was the former lieutenant in charge of the identification section at the Davenport Police Department. Brilliant guy. I mean, I knew him back in the day. Very, very sharp and had a lot going for him. And he was very poised and very precise and on the witness stand and dealt with the lawyers very well. So what would you like to know, Ben?
Well, the DNA expert in particular, because I know that you've said in the past that what makes this case somewhat unique is that there's been somewhat of a lack of forensic evidence involved. But here we have a DNA expert come to testify. What did he or she talk about?
Well, it was a she, and she talked about, you know, of course, when this crime happened in 1990, DNA was really at its infancy, DNA testing, I should say. The first DNA forensic case was in 1987, and that was in England. And so it was just really at the very beginning for the U.S. and DNA testing. And you had to have a fair amount of material to test back in those days. And at the time, they just didn't recover enough material to test. So, and of course, there's been enormous advances in the last 27 years on DNA testing. And so they took a lot of the materials that have been collected in 1990 and sent them back in for tests. And, you know, among the things they could find were Stanley Liggins's hotel bed linens. And they found multiple stains on the linens that they tested, and lo and behold, each one would come back as a mathematical certainty as being a match for Stanley Liggins. Now, in several of the stains, they found he had a partner, but those stains had degraded enough over the last 28 years that they couldn't adequately test him to see who the partner was. And of course, that's the question. Did Stanley Liggins bring Jennifer Lewis back to his hotel room and sexually assault her? Or did he go someplace else and sexually assault her? We don't know. I mean, the absence of evidence does not necessarily mean innocence. It just means there's no evidence there. You know, we know that he was sexually involved with some people, because that shows up on the there, but we just don't know who those people were. And so that's one of the big questions right now. Another thing that came up is Sarah B. Braden, someone who said she saw people in the near the school, other than Stanley Liggins, and she is not going to be allowed to testify because apparently she's having some mental health issues. That's what came out in court today. We don't know what those issues are or anything else. So they're going to read her transcript into the record, which is unfortunate because you can't. It's a lot easier to evaluate the truthfulness of somebody if you're actually seeing them as opposed to just listening to what's being read to you. And I guess the star of today's courtroom testimony was Denny Kern. He was a lieutenant retired from the Davenport Police Department and then took over, became a criminalist for the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation.
And what made Kern the star witness?
You know, it wasn't so much what he said, it's just how he said it. I mean, he explained things very carefully and in a detailed manner. He talked about, you know, the evidence they did have. They found this gas can in the trunk of the car. It was driven by Stanley Liggins. It had his fingerprints on it. But hey, if it was his gas can, you'd expect it to have his fingerprints on it. We talked about, he talked about a lot of different things he tested, different types of fingerprinting he did. But the bottom line is, there's very little forensic evidence that directly connects Stanley Liggins to Jennifer Lewis. I mean, the most telling evidence they have is those garbage bags we talked about the other day that appear to be the same kind, brand and type of garbage bag that she was wrapped in when she was set on fire as what's available at the Hillside Inn in Rock Island. But that's not a slam dunk by any means. As they don't have any DNA linking her to Stanley's hotel room. We don't have any fingerprints or any other forensic evidence linking Liggins to where Jennifer's body was found. We don't have anything linking Jennifer to Stanley's car. You put it all together and it's just, well, no, it's not there.
So based on your coverage of the previous trials, who do you expect the defense is going to call the stand once the prosecution rests its case?
I don't know. The one I really want to know whether they'll call or not is Stanley Liggins himself. Wouldn't it be interesting to see? He didn't testify in the first two trials, probably in part because it would bring out some of his past criminal behavior. But now, you know, the Iowa law is any crimes you've committed in the previous 10 years. Well, he's been in prison for more than 20. So now there's a question as to whether the clock starts running from the date of the crime, 10 years behind that, or is it 10 years from now? If it's 10 years from now, he could present himself as having someone with a clean record. So it'll be interesting to see if Stanley Liggins himself testifies. But I think beyond that, what the defense is going to be doing is just poking holes in the prosecution's witnesses, you know, showing what's wrong or the inconsistencies of them. And you'd expect inconsistencies after 28 years. That's just kind of the way it is.
And based on your experience in court reporting, does the defense spend more time, less time than the prosecution in their case?
Typically, the prosecution has a longer case simply because the burden of proof's on them to prove that somebody's guilty. That's a generalization, but that's generally what I've found.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to mention?
No, not really. Interesting trial.
Sure. All right. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Rosie.
We are the Voice of the Victim podcast. Every Thursday, we discuss cases that have been influenced by abuse in some way and try to make sense of these senseless things.
We also try to identify the missed opportunities where people could have made a difference in the future of the victim.
We hope to help others know what to look for so we can protect ourselves and our children.
Subscribe to us on your favorite app and help us spread our message.
And remember, if you see something, say something.
We are all the voice of the victim.